first hour of Issues Etc. today is Open Lines. We will have a guest a little later in this hour of Open Lines, just the last 10 minutes or so, Representative Jody Stefanik. She's a Republican from Baldwin. We're going to be talking to her. Well, she serves on the House Health Care Policy Committee for the Missouri State House, and they passed last Wednesday the Woman's Right to Know bill. Not the House, but the committee passed the bill, and the House will take it up. We'll find out exactly what the bill is and what its prospects in the Missouri State House are later in this hour of Open Lines. It's Open Lines for now. The phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. In the next hour, we'll be talking first with John Moorhead of Watchman Fellowship about this UFO cult called the Raelians. He's written a couple articles on them. Wesley Smith joins us for the remainder of that second hour to talk about a new report from Oregon on assisted suicide. And then in the last hour of the program, the author of our Issues Etc. book of the month joins us for the last installment in this monthly series, this month-long series we've been doing with him on the church growth movement. His book is called Testing the Claims of Church Growth. Pastor Rod Zwanitzer joins us to talk about alternatives to the church growth movement in the last hour of Issues Etc. today. It's Open Lines, and as always, anything you'd like to talk about, the phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Now, I did want to talk a little bit about this. It was in the paper. What paper was this in? The St. Louis Post-Dispatch, if I'm not mistaken, as I open up here. Whoop. Yes, it looked. No, it's the Chicago Star Tribune. It's the Star Tribune. And here it is. The Belief-O-Matic puts your faith and beliefs to the test. I'll tell you a little bit about this. I took the test, and I came out exactly as I am. No different, although the test is not perfect. But first, how many of you have seen, or at the very least heard, of this movie that is apparently the talk of everyone? It is called, is it called God and Generals? Gods and Generals, in the plural? I obviously have not seen it. Now, we got a few promotional things at the radio station here on this, and of course I didn't pay any attention to it because it looked like promotional stuff. And I hear that it's actually out in the movie theaters. Everyone who has seen this is raving about it. I heard about it on the radio today as well. There's an article from Michael Medved, Culture Clash, God, Generals, and Ted Turner, that he posted this weekend talking about this. Now, if you saw Gods and Generals this weekend, or if you know of someone who did and who's telling you all about it, I was told today that if I haven't seen it, I need to see it. Great. That's what Craig says. Is it great, Craig? Awesome. It's awesome, he says. Awesome. I very seldom miss things that are awesome. If you saw it this weekend or if you know someone who did, let's hear your review during this hour of Open Lines. The phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I am Mr. Skeptical. Do you remember right about the time that the movie Bodyguard came out? Who's the guy who starred in that? Kevin Costner. And Field of Dreams, shortly before that, if I'm not mistaken. I swore I would never see a Kevin Costner movie. Because everyone was telling me that Kevin Costner was like the second coming of Christ. It's just the greatest thing. He was everywhere. He was so overexposed, I decided I'd been exposed enough. And I didn't, well, I did eventually see Bodyguard, but I never saw Field of Dreams, probably to my detriment. And there are a couple other things that I simply refused to see because everyone's talking about them, everyone making a big deal out of them. Maybe Gods and Generals will be one of them. Who knows? Is it something I shouldn't miss? Give me your review, 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. What is the title about? Gods and Generals. Michael Medved writes this, and it's an open letter to Ted Turner, multi-billionaire, founder of CNN, media mogul, owner of Atlanta Braves, you name it. Very prominent liberal, former husband of Jane Fonda. When they divorced last year, he said it was very clearly over the fact that she'd become a Christian. This is what Medved writes to Turner. Dear Ted Turner, at this advanced stage of your long and complicated career, you have finally crossed the line making a contribution to your country and its culture so unequivocally positive and powerful that every American, regardless of political perspective, owes you a debt of gratitude. No matter how one feels about your creation, CNN, your donation of $1 billion to the UN, your marriage to Jane Fonda, your operation of the Atlanta Braves, your divorce from Jane Fonda, your dismissal of Christianity as, quote, a religion for losers, your bison ranching, your yachting, or your financial feud with Rupert Murdoch, you have now performed a massive good deed that should provoke universal appreciation. Not that gods and generals produced due to your singular determination and generosity constitutes a perfect film. Many commentators, especially among your politically correct pals, will no doubt find fault with it for a portrayal of the war between the states that aims for truth rather than trendiness. Nevertheless, your personal investment of some $80 million in a project of such audacious ambition that resulted in the major movie Miracle. I've been reviewing movies for, this is Medved writing to Turner. I've been reviewing movies for 23 years now, having started at CNN, in fact. I've never before sat spellbound for nearly 4 hours. The film runs more than 3 hours and 40 minutes with an intermission, wishing at the end that this heroic movie had gone on even longer. Have you seen this, Gods and Generals? Maybe you're still seeing it if it's 4 hours long. You might still be in the movie theater if you started last night. Is it really everything it's cracked up to be? The guy who is sitting in for Rush Limbaugh today, Roger Hedgecock, it was everything he could talk about. Suddenly he was borrowing themes from the movie in order to make political commentary. Michael Medved goes on, despite the epic scale of this effort, director-writer Ron Maxwell reached the right decision in making no attempt for comprehensive coverage of the period he illuminates. The movie begins April 1861 and constitutes 25 months and concludes 25 months later, making no reference to epic battles like the Pennsylvania campaign or to more important personalities like McClellan, Winfield Scott, Halleck, or Fremont, even though Maxwell focuses most of his attention on the single fascinating figure of Stonewall Jackson, he never portrays that general's most astonishing triumph, the breathtakingly brilliant Shenandoah Valley campaign in the spring of 1862, still studied today as an example of inspired leadership and masterful tactics. Maxwell chooses to concentrate on the general's human qualities rather than his undeniable military genius, and the result is a film that should appeal to women as much as men, to history fanatics, as well as those who don't know the difference between Bull Run and Valley Forge. This is an open letter from Michael Medved to Ted Turner. Now he goes on and on. He says, Gods and Generals inflames the imagination and inspires the soul, never more than in its frank, friendly treatment of the deep religiosity of men on both sides. The compassionate recreation of so many vivid, decent characters never apologizes the paradox that soldiers in both blue and gray remain convicted that they served the Almighty's will in battle. And Maxwell, the director, the man behind this, allows us to believe that both sides may have been right. Apparently, Ted Turner even makes a cameo. Well, not a cameo. Makes a small bit part appearance in this. Did you see him, Craig? There's a fine moment, Mr. Turner, writes Medved, when your smiling face appears for a few seconds along with other Confederate officers listening to a spirited rendition of the music hall favorite, The Bonnie Blue Flag. Did you see Ted in that group? That's what $80 million will buy you if you want to get into a movie, a bit part. We are a band of brothers and native to the soil, sing these sons of the South. And that sense of regional pride and loyalty to hearth and home permeates this remarkable and richly rewarding movie. Medved concludes, this movie, in fact, could amount to a turning of the tide in the ongoing battle to enrich and uplift the culture. Now, that's saying something. Medved, I respect many of his opinions on film and culture. He says this actually might represent the turning of the tide to uplift the culture. If that occurs, we must thank God and two generals, Ron Maxwell, and that unlikely leader for the cause of the angels, Ted Turner. As in any great battle, deliverance can come from unexpected sources. Thank you, Mr. Turner, and I wish you great success with your courageous effort. He gives it 4 stars. It's rated PG-13, so even Craig can see it. Although it does have some intense battlefield violence, which, if I understand my history correctly, so did the Civil War. Did you see this movie? Are you as taken with it as Michael Medved? 4 hours and still wanting more. Moved to write an open letter to Ted Turner in praise of Turner's efforts behind the film. What do you think? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Let's start with Dave, who's calling from St. Charles. Dave, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes, I've read and seen a little bit about Guys and Generals 2, Breakpoint. Charles Colson's Breakpoint lavished it with praise in terms of the faith and the faithfulness in marriage, etc. That's portrayed in the movie in all kind of good positions. But I suggest people also read Gene V's review of it in World Magazine. He tempered a little bit that it's clearly a movie about a war of northern aggression against the South, so it's from a southern slant.
Well, and you would expect as much from Ted Turner, who is, if he's anything, he's a son of the South.
And he also portrays Lincoln in a kind of a dark light, in other words, so it doesn't show forth the faith, etc. of Lincoln.
But did you see the film, Dave?
I haven't seen it. I just read V's article. He brought that out in it, so.
All right. Thank you very much, Dave. I appreciate that. And I had not seen V's review, although someone is scurrying at this very moment to bring it to my waiting hands. But if you want to read it, you can read it on worldmag.com. That's World Magazine's website. And if you go to the culture section, that's probably where V's review of Gods and Generals is. What's your review, if you saw it? Did it appear on television at first and then in the theaters? I'm not sure how this worked out. I just know that just about the time I saw the promotional material for Gods and Generals, you'd walk outside and people are, the first thing you hear is Gods and Generals. It's almost more on the tips of our tongues than Iraq and Saddam Hussein. The phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I saw this in the paper, what paper again is this? The Star Tribune, and it's down at the bottom of the fold on the variety section, the entertainment section. Belief-O-Matic puts your faith and beliefs to the test. Here's the story. It's very short. Ever wonder what faith, if any, you have? Do we have the answer for you? The Belief-O-Matic. Instead of veggies, this O-Matic slices and dices your faith. And it's free. We didn't say accurate, just free. After you answer Belief-O-Matic's 20 questions about life, faith, and such, the machine rates what faith you most closely line up with. And it also says, warning, Belief-O-Matic assumes no legal liability for the ultimate fate of your soul. A co-worker who is a United Methodist came out as a Reformed Jew. The Reverend Rich Melheim, an Evangelical Lutheran Church in America pastor with a wonderful sense of humor, said he came out 100% Quaker. Melheim is founder of Faith Incubators, a Stillwater-based ecumenical Christian education think tank that makes ministry models for parents who want to be the primary faith mentors of their children. Melheim said he couldn't answer 2 questions. One, on good works, misses the entire point of the Reformed Church that good works do not earn your place in heaven. That was earned for you by Christ himself, he says. Good works are not a requirement, but a result of a person touched by God's grace and joyously looking for a way to say thank you in response, says Melheim. And the question on abortion was very difficult for him to answer. He said he didn't believe he had to answer it either. I believe abortion must be legally a choice, but also I believe that 98% of the time it is a tragic and bad choice. So he didn't answer that question. So there you have it, how a Luther became a Quaker for a few minutes on a snowy afternoon. And you can find it on beliefnet.com. On the left side, there's a little link to it. I went there out of curiosity. I'd seen it before, but I'd never taken the test. And there are 20 questions, multiple choice. Some of them you can answer with more than one answer. And then after each question, you are asked to rate the priority of each question in your faith. I came out as, here's the list. It gives you, 27 different categories, and you're rated in each and every category. I came out as 100% mainline to conservative Christian Protestant. 100%. But I also came out as 86% Eastern Orthodox, 86% Roman Catholic, and I am apparently, according to Belief-O-Matic, 81% Seventh-day Adventist. And I'm 76% Church of Jesus Christ Latter-day Saints. I'm 75% Quaker and apparently 67% Orthodox Jew, and a little bit of Jehovah Witness tossed in there too. If I go down to the very bottom of the list, I am a secular humanist, 3%, 5% Taoist, and 7% New Age. Now the questions range from the first one, what is the number and nature of the deity, which I had a hard time answering, because I can say as a Trinitarian Christian that God is one God, three persons. It didn't give me that option. So I had to choose the one closest to the right option, which is only one God, a corporeal spirit, supreme, personal, God Almighty, the Creator. No, I chose the second one, incorporeal, no body. Another question, are there human incarnations of God, or gods, or goddesses? Now here was a good one. God is supreme and has no incarnations. The second one, which I chose, was one incarnation. There's also a place for many or countless incarnations. There are questions about the creation of the universe, what happens to human beings after death. Where it gets really difficult to answer these questions is when it gets to questions of salvation and how a person is saved. Because it doesn't have any of the, it does not have the right answer in there. You have to choose the one that is closest to the right answer. It asks about baptism, about confession and repentance, about doing good works. And then it asks a few questions of the social and moral nature, such as question 13, elective abortion should be accepted, with which I disagreed. Homosexual behavior should be regarded as immoral or out of harmony, with which I agreed. Roles for women and men should be prescribed. I agreed with that one. Not only should they be prescribed, they are. Ask questions about divorce, social betterment, nonviolence, prayer, meditation, and healing. And then finally, the last question, number 20, revering nature or the environment should be fundamental, with which I disagreed. But on none of these questions was I able to answer unequivocally. And I still came out 100% Christian Protestant, which is close enough, I guess, if for beliefnet.com, because they didn't have a category for Lutheran. And as we all know, that's a category all by itself. There's a progressive church, according to the Associated Press, in San Francisco. No surprise here. It's an Episcopal church, St. John the Evangelist, that has always prided itself on being a model of inclusiveness and compassion. But of course, as we all know, those who tout their inclusiveness and their compassion often have some limits on those two things. This church has welcomed the homeless, AIDS-stricken members, hired openly gay priests, adopted the motto, diverse people, inquiring minds, open hearts. But after some of the congregation leaders warmed to New Age spirituality, a big rift opened up in the 145-year-old church that has yet to fully heal. The problem centered, and get this, the problem centered on a church-affiliated dance group called St. John's Divine Rhythm Society. The name of the congregation is St. John the Evangelist. It's an Episcopal church in San Francisco. This church-affiliated dance group called St. John's Divine Rhythm Society sounds innocuous enough. What are you picturing? Blue-haired old ladies in their velour sweatsuits standing in the gymnasium doing rhythm exercises. No, that's not what was happening. In fact, the group is being alleged to have condoned, if not promoted, illegal drug use and all-night parties modeled on raves. Now, there might have been some blue-haired ladies there in velour sweatsuits, and it might have taken place in the gym, but apparently the date rape drug, ecstasy, and several other, and lots of flashing lights had something to do with this as well. Now, the Rhythm Society was formed in the early 1990s as an exclusive club. The idea was to find a way to provide spiritual seekers a way to dance toward enlightenment. This isn't an Episcopal church in San Francisco. The society began hosting quarterly invitation-only gatherings at St. John's, midnight to morning celebrations featuring DJs, light shows, and New Age themes. Kind of like the youth group lock-in with drugs and lasers. The gathering drew about 350 people, more than three times the number that belonged to the church. They ranged from children to seniors, but the core group consists of adults in their 20s and 30s. The group never pretended that it could use dance to further the Christian gospel, but according to parishioners on both sides of the debate, the priest's predecessor, the Reverend David Nogard, saw it as an opportunity to inject new energy into the dwindling ranks of his congregation and the church's landmark Victorian building. I mean, whatever brings them in, even if it's dancing toward enlightenment. I guess that's the way things work. Now, although the association seemed to work early on, it took a troubled turn after a new priest's arrival, Kevin Pearson. He arrived in August of 2001. Did he shut it down? Did he get angry and say, what are we doing with New Age DJ music and light shows all night with the possibility of drugs in our church? No, he didn't shut it down. He embraced it wholeheartedly. The 41-year-old rector's embrace of the Rhythm Society apparently was done, according to allegations, at the expense of the rest of his flock. Some objected to some of the changes that the priest also introduced to the established liturgy, such as, well, this one seems harmless enough, doesn't it? Directing the church choir to chant the Hindu mantra Om instead of the Nicene Creed. Instead of confessing the Christian faith once delivered to the saints, let's just chant to the rhythm of the universe. Unlike the previous pastor, Kevin, the priest, became very interested in what we were doing, said Michael Lazar, a videographer who has acted as the Rhythm Society spokesman. Frankly, he saw the group as very active, very bright people coming in and making more use of the space. The tensions climaxed last summer when a man attending the society's June function was found unconscious in a church restroom, the victim of apparently an overdose of GHB, the so-called date rape drug. The man survived, but parishioners began calling for a split between the church and the society. Apparently, the priest was asked to resign. He did. There were further allegations of people being ejected from the church grounds because they appeared to be high on something. What will happen to the St. John's Rhythm Society, St. John the Divine's Rhythm Society, is unclear. But for a brief and shining moment, it brought the people in. It's Open Lines, Issues, etc. When we come back, about 15 more minutes of Open Lines, then we'll be joined by Representative Jody Stefanik, Republican from Baldwin, to talk about the Woman's Right to Know bill that passed the Missouri House Committee, a committee in the Missouri House. That's at the end of the hour.
For truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
When the church proclaims the gospel of Jesus Christ in the open marketplace of ideas, is the customer always right? Can we market the Christian gospel? Is it proper for the Christian church to adopt a business model? In our Issues, Etc. book of the month for February, Testing the Claims of Church Growth, author Rod Zwanitzer says the answer to all these questions is no. You can order Testing the Claims of Church Growth online. Go to our website at issuesetc.org, click on the What's New section, and you'll find a link to Concordia Publishing House. Or call 1-800-325-3040 and ask to receive the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February, Testing the Claims of Church Growth. 1-800-325-3040. Call during regular business hours or visit issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section, and there you'll find information on how to order Testing the Claims of Church Growth.
Now this Global Minute lets you hear a gospel breakthrough that took place in India. A man named Abraham grew up in a wealthy Muslim home, but he had no peace. The incident was reported through the Christian Development Agency, Interserve. Abraham had a nagging feeling that he tried to console by going on a pilgrimage to Mecca, just like millions of faithful Muslims. However, he still had no peace. He was working for his father, and on a business trip, his car broke down near a Christian church. He got it fixed, but the car broke down another time outside the same church. It happened again, and he finally decided to meet the pastor who shared Christ's words from Matthew 11:28. "Come to me, and I'll give you peace." He chose to follow Christ, but his father then kicked him out of the house and has since disowned him. Workers with Interserve meet Christians in Asia who have made tough decisions to follow Christ. Pray for them to have courage. Learn more by logging on to missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. From the Alamo, Lieutenant Colonel William Travis wrote this on February 24, 1836. "Fellow citizens and compatriots, I am besieged by 1,000 or more Mexicans under Santa Anna. I have sustained a continual bombardment and cannonade for 24 hours and have not lost a man. The enemy has demanded a surrender at discretion. Otherwise, the garrison are to be put to the sword. I have answered the demand with a cannon shot, and our flag still waves proudly from the walls. I shall never surrender or retreat." The letter goes on and concludes with this P.S. "The Lord is on our side." Psalm 27 says, "The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? Though an army besiege me, my heart will not fear. The war break out against me, even then will I be confident." Travis, the psalmist, confident men. For confidence today, set your heart on your Creator and Savior. Focused on God, everything else will prove secondary. That's confidence.
You've heard the saying, all things being equal, friends buy from friends. Well, it gets even better when your friend sells you something for a much lower price than other people are paying. And Lifeline Long Distance is a Christian company, so we'll donate 10% of every long distance call you make for the advancement of the gospel. Hey, after all, what are friends for? Lifeline, long distance with a higher calling.
To sign up for Lifeline Long Distance service and benefit AM 850 KFUO, call 1-800-607-5128.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we will conclude our series with Pastor Tom Baker on A Theology of Glory versus A Theology of the Cross. We'll be concluding that series we've been doing with him on the Heidelberg Disputation and wrap things up with Tom tomorrow on Issues Etc. It's open lines for the next 10-15 minutes. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Well, Michael Medved couldn't say enough things, good things about gods and generals, and wrote an open letter to Ted Turner praising his funding and backing of the film. What did you think about it? 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727. Matt is calling from Richmond Heights. Hi, Matt. Welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, Pastor Todd. Thanks. I did happen to browse on the internet last night to see what was showing up at the Galleria, which is near my home, and it was about 6:30, and I asked my wife if I could sneak away for about a four-hour movie, and she said sure. And so in a blizzard, I went up and caught the 7 o'clock showing of Gods and Generals, and I counted there's 22 other people, and about 25% of them were black people, and it was just quite an enjoyable film, and I had tears in my eyes two or three different times, and it was quite biblical from the standpoint of people that were devout there, and I would say that was true, that it did kind of come from the southern viewpoint, which even though born a northerner, I have come to that viewpoint more as I've moved along in understanding. And so I was thinking at the end of the movie that Jane Fonda must have her Christianity supposedly must have worn off on Ted Turner a little bit, because he's been rather anti-Christian in some of his comments before.
Well, you know, he has, and as far as I know, at least in his personal life, it hasn't worn off that much. I mean, they were divorced on account of it. Matt, thank you very much for the call. So Matt saw Gods and Generals, tears in his eyes, even braved the snowstorm last night. Few of us did that. I did it because I had to, had no choice. But sliding out to the movie theater, and others did as well, to see Gods and Generals. Apparently this is the prequel to Gettysburg, another very famous Turner classic kind of a movie. That now, that wasn't just 4 hours. That was a series of, like a mini-series kind of a thing. And apparently, at least from the people who were talking to me here during the breaks, Gods and Generals is the prequel to Gettysburg, and after Gettysburg there comes another book. And who knows whether that will be made into a movie. What did you think about it? Michael Medved, who has no, very few areas of agreement with Ted Turner, has written an open letter praising him for funding, backing this film, and for it in particular, its depiction, its positive depiction of faith. Do you plan on seeing it? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. The World Council of Churches, according to the AP in Switzerland, said on Friday that they are issuing a condemnation of a possible war against Iraq as, quote, immoral and unwise, and they praised U.S. and British churches for standing up to politicians in their countries. In a statement, the Executive Committee of the World Council of Churches said, quote, it strongly deplores the fact that the most powerful nations of this world again regard war as an acceptable instrument of foreign policy. The World Council of Churches, of course, represents 350 to 400 million Protestant, Orthodox, and other non-Roman Catholic churches in more than 100 countries. An attack on Iraq at this stage would be, quote, would, quote, lower the threshold for using violent means to solve international conflicts. War against Iraq would be immoral, unwise, and in breach of the principles of the United Nations Charter. They called for a day of prayer and peace in Iraq at the beginning of Lent. That's interesting. I don't know if anyone in Iraq is going to be observing Lent. And in most Protestant churches on March 9th in the Orthodox tradition. The committee said it was has equal concern about Iraqi violations of human rights, and then called on Iraq to comply with the U.S. Security Council resolutions. But of course, there, no condemnations of immorality or a lack of wisdom on the part of Saddam Hussein. Churches around the world, and especially in the United States and its allies, have called on the U.S. government to pull back from war with Iraq. Not all. Some of them are wisely remaining silent where they cannot speak from God's word. The National Council of Churches in the United States, that's a subset of the World Council of Churches, has requested a meeting with President George W. Bush, and a delegation from the U.S. Council met earlier this week with British Prime Minister Tony Blair. The World Council of Churches executives praised the church for their, quote, courageous stance in standing up to political leaders in their countries. Now, there's no surprise there. Rabbi Shmuley Boteach, he is, we talk about him from time to time here on Issues, etc. He is the kind of ultra-liberal Jewish rabbi who goes toe-to-toe with Albert Mohler often on television debates, has written an op-ed piece called Just Plain Human, talking about Michael Jackson and his self-destructive slide that has been, I don't know what's going on, I think it's actually a brilliant move on the part of Jackson's agents and publicists to get him as much exposure as he has had in the last 2 weeks on television. But Rabbi Boteach says Michael Jackson's destruction wasn't a revealing documentary, but setting himself up as an idol to be worshipped. Michael Jackson has endured many scandals in his career, but none like the one he is enmeshed in now. While accused of child molestation in 1993, he was never arrested, charged, or indicted, or convicted. But now he has gone on international television and announced that he regularly invites children into his bed. I have seen Michael around children, including Gavin, the innocent young boy tragically stricken with cancer, who was featured on a recent documentary on countless occasions. I have no reason whatsoever to believe that he has ever abused a child, says Rabbi Boteach, but that doesn't excuse the preposterous act of an adult inviting someone else's child into their bed, however innocently. I'm amazed that there is something here upon which there's something that he finds wrong. I'm amazed because on virtually every other issue, Rabbi Boteach is unwilling to draw the moral line. Now, he goes on to say that really what Michael is suffering from is self-worship, allowing himself as an idol to be worshipped. And, you know, who draws the line for idols? Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Greg is calling from Highland. Greg, welcome to Issues Etc. Greg, welcome. All right, we'll get him back if we can. Rabbi Boteach says this. Many chart the beginning of the fall of Michael Jackson in 1993 to the molestation accusations. I find a different starting point. It took place when Sony launched his History album in 1995. Accompanying the release were, unbelievably, giant statues of Michael placed in cities all over the world, including London and Prague, as well as a video depicting Michael as a gargantuan idol, complete with thousands of soldier worshippers at his beck and call. I still remember watching this video with Michael at his Neverland Valley Ranch Theater for the first time in August 2000. Michael was reliving the nostalgia of his earlier music videos, but I nearly fell off my chair. Here was a man who had been a devout Jehovah Witness with an innate, authentic, and deep-seated spirituality, setting himself up as a god. Michael's mother, Catherine, spends hours each day reading the Bible, and Michael himself, very virtuously, went witnessing for his church every single Sunday, knocking from door to door to sell the Watchtower magazine, even after the Thriller album made him the biggest star on the planet. Few people understand how a deeply religious man Michael was, and in his own way still is, says Rabbi Boteach. But how could a man with such a deep attachment to God suddenly make himself into a deity? I'm not making this into a religious issue or implying that Michael's downfall came about as a result of sacrilege. Rather, what happened to Michael was that once he set himself up as an idol to be adored, it was but a short step to creating his own rules and living by his own set of laws. And if the world says that sleeping with another person's kid is wrong, then the world be damned, says Rabbi Boteach. We have Greg back here. Greg, welcome to Issues Etc. Thanks for waiting.
Thanks.
What's up?
Oh, not much. Not much. I saw Gods and Generals last night.
Did you?
Yep, great film.
What, tell me about it.
Basically, it seemed to follow the life of Stonewall Jackson from his time at VMI and then through the war and then until his death. Of course, it followed other people, other generals, and other particular men, but he would seem to be the focus of the film.
And was it as we had a caller earlier, Matt, who said that he braved the same snowstorm to go out and see it, and he said he had tears in his eyes at several points. A very moving film, an excellent film. What did you think?
I would have to agree with that. There were parts in there where, honestly, I don't know enough about Stonewall Jackson to know if this is true, but there was a part where he was dealing with somebody's daughter, and the daughter did eventually die, and that was quite moving. So there were some really good parts in there.
What was the depiction in the film? This is what people are raving about, and Michael Medved raves about it as well in an open letter to Ted Turner today. But what was the depiction in the film of the Christian faith in particular? Apparently, that seemed to permeate the storyline.
Well, it was exceptionally strong for these men. They, in particular, like, let's say, Stonewall Jackson, for him, he accepted what God was going to do with his life, and he didn't fear death because he feared if that's what God wanted, then that would be okay with him, and he accepted it. So it was a thy will be done, and he didn't have fear about what he was doing on the battlefield because he feared when God wanted to call him home, he could accept that calling, even though he just had a child. He was recently, I think, remarried or married, I'm not sure which, I think he was remarried. But he accepted that if he did die, it would be all right because it was God's calling him home.
Greg, thank you very much for the call.
Sure.
These kind of things just make me curious when you hear everyone talking about something, and it's virtually everywhere you look, and everyone's talking about gods and generals. It just makes you curious. We'll keep an eye on it. We're going to spend the last few minutes of this hour talking with Representative Jody Stefanik, a Republican from Baldwin. She serves on the House Health Care Policy Committee that passed this Woman's Right to Know bill in the Missouri State House last week. Representative Stefanik, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you.
Tell us about the Woman's Right to Know bill.
Well, the bill is House Bill number 156. Anyone can have a look at what the bill says on the Missouri House of Representatives website. And basically what that bill requires is that when a woman goes in to have an abortion, she goes through some counseling with the doctor, and they go over the pros and cons, the alternatives to abortion. And in the past, what could happen is that that woman can then directly go into having the procedure. What this bill requires is that from the point of that counseling, that the woman needs to wait 24 hours before she can actually have the abortion, and that is the biggest impact of this bill.
Does this bill require that the doctor, the abortion practitioner himself, do the counseling?
The bill actually says the treating physician has to confer with the patient. So I would take that to be, yes, it's the physician that has to do the counseling.
And is it a strict 24 hours? In other words, if she comes in at 5 o'clock, a few minutes before closing time, mm-hmm. and then simply comes back the next day, does that suffice, or is it going to be required a strict 24-hour?
No, sir, that would not. The bill states clearly at least 24 hours.
Are there any other bills that you are aware of in other states that are similar to this, basically a 24-hour waiting period?
You know, I do believe there are some bills out there, but I have not researched other states enough to really comment on which states those are.
Where do you think this bill is going to go? Do you think it has a good prospect in the entire House?
I do, for a few reasons. In talking to my colleagues on both sides of the aisle, I think that it is that more Republicans are pro-life than are pro-choice by far. But I also believe that the Democratic caucus has a nice size of numbers that consider themselves to be pro-life. In fact, a few weeks ago, Representative Ed Emery and Representative Rachel Bringer, Ed Emery being a Republican, Rachel Bringer being a Democrat, put together a caucus called the Sanctity of Life Caucus, and basically went around to all House members, I'm not sure if they talked to everyone or not, and asked them if they wanted to be on the Sanctity of Life Caucus. And we have at least 70. Now, we have 163 in the House. But knowing that that caucus was formed by a Republican and a Democrat, and there are both parties represented on the caucus, leads me to believe that if this bill would get its shot on the floor of the House, that it would have a very good chance of passing, I would think.
And what's going to determine whether or not it gets that shot?
Well, it is up to the Speaker of the House to determine what gets put on the calendar. The chairman of the committee also has a say in that, as well as the majority floor leader. So it would be a decision that would come about from those different parties, and I'm sure, you know, opinions and recommendations of other representatives will help that get to the floor.
Its prospects in the Senate then, and then on the governor's desk, what do you think about that?
I don't know. I can't speak for the governor, definitely. I'm not sure what he would do with that. In the Senate, I would hope that in the Senate it would also have an equally good shot with a Republican majority. I see no reason why we shouldn't be hopeful that it should get through the Senate as well.
Some opponents of the bill have already been speaking out pretty loudly. They are saying, among other things, that the bill is an insult to women. It implies women don't think about the issue of abortion. One, the Reverend Rebecca Turner of the Missouri Religious mm-hmm. Coalition for Reproductive Choice said that a woman has the right not to bring a child into the world when she can't care for it. She says the motive of this bill is to eliminate abortion. It would put an undue hardship on women considering abortion. How do you respond?
Well, in public testimony of which the Reverend was a part of, we heard 12 witnesses that testified in favor for the bill, some of them very emotional testimonies, and then we had 10 witnesses that that testified against the bill. Reverend Turner was certainly one of those, and she and I had some questions going back and forth about it being inconvenient and not easy for a woman to come back, to come in for counseling and then to come back 24 hours later for the abortion. And my response to that was that it is really not our job to make an abortion convenient for women. I'm extremely pro-life myself, and I was almost offended by that comment. But if a woman is really, really basing this decision on her inconvenience, her level of inconvenience, I would think that 48 hours is a lot less of an inconvenience than what she would be putting towards a lifetime of raising a child and having that. So I think that this is necessary for us to have. It should have happened long ago. I think it gives women the time, once they are counseled and have all of the information, for them to then spend the 24 hours with all the information to consider this life-altering choice that they're about to go through.
Now, the situation this bill is designed to remedy, what was it, what was going on in the abortion clinic beyond the fact that there wasn't any waiting period? Was there insufficient counseling for women considering abortion?
I don't know if we had any evidence to suggest that there was insufficient counseling being done, and I don't know that a woman won't go in now and have insufficient counseling. Certainly, you know, that's something that that's hard to track unless a state employee is always out there when that counseling goes on. But I think that at least they should end up with pamphlets of material, so even if the counselor even if the physician doesn't do a fantastic job with the counseling, I think that the woman will be provided with at least written material and have had that exposure to what can go wrong, what are the risks, what are the alternatives, and given that 24 hours, I think she'll be able to make a better decision.
Are there circumstances, does this bill envision circumstances under which the 24-hour waiting period might be waived?
Yes. There is language in the bill that says if the woman's life is in danger and if the 24-hour waiting period could cause death, then that 24-hour waiting period could be waived.
Now, an earlier version of the bill would have required doctors who perform abortions to register proof of medical malpractice insurance. What was the aim of that, and why is that no longer part of this bill?
It actually still is part of the bill. There was a lot of discussion on it. The House Committee substitute that I'm referring to now, that I'm looking at, still has the proof of medical malpractice. We have, I think, four doctors on the health care policy committee, and when that, I'm not a doctor, so I can't speak to it directly, but from what they said, Democrats, Republicans, some of them voted against the bill and said that they thought that was a portion of the bill that was very much acceptable, that a doctor should have the medical malpractice insurance when going through a procedure. So it seemed like there was no objection, no matter if they were pro-life or pro-choice, on that issue.
If this bill coming out of this House committee makes it through the House, through the Missouri Senate, and then, by some twist of fate perhaps, is signed by Governor Holden, do you expect it to be challenged in the courts?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. I really just hope that it gets the shot to go through our process right here.
Now, someone is going to say, this is an incremental step. This is the gradualist's approach to curtailing all abortion rights in the state of Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
And I am with you. I'm entirely pro-life, and I would probably be one to say, you know, yeah, it is. If we can chip away at it piece by piece, we will, and be rather upfront with that. Are you willing to say that?
I have no problem saying that if this should decrease the amount of abortions that we have, then that's a good thing. I stand behind that 100%.
I am a resident of the state of Illinois. There is a world of difference between abortion laws in Missouri and abortion laws in Illinois. Does it concern you that right across the border, especially for St. Louis residents, there is much easier, much freer access to abortion in Illinois, especially mm-hmm. without parental consent or parental notification?
I'm sorry, what was the question?
Well, does it concern you that basically Illinois serves as an escape valve for those who want to escape the abortion laws in Missouri?
Yeah, that definitely would be a concern. I'm not sure. I know we do have, especially young women, going over into Illinois for abortions, and that certainly is something that we can try to prevent from happening, I would be in support of doing that as well.
How do you gauge the makeup of the, just talking about the House here, how do you gauge the makeup of the House with regard to the issue of life? Is it predominantly pro-life, predominantly pro-choice? Is it split down the middle?
I would think that we are, I can't give you numbers, I'm not sure exactly. I think that we have a nice percentage of Democrats that probably consider themselves pro-life. I know those that are in the St. Louis County area, many of them, and not all of them, but many of them ran on a platform that included being pro-life. I don't think we have a 75% majority being pro-life, but I think we have over our 50% that would make something like this happen.
And where does the Speaker of the House sit on this issue?
I don't want to speak for the Speaker of the House, but I believe that Speaker Hanaway is pro-life, but I do not know how she would vote on this bill or any other bill, actually.
With only 1 minute before we will let you go here, Representative Stefanik, why is this woman's right to know bill important for Missourians?
I think it's important for Missourians because this will give women, no matter what circumstance in life that they may be in, obviously this is not an easy choice for a woman to make, and I think that having this 24-hour waiting period will allow her 24 hours being fully informed. Now, I'm not saying that women are not informed when they go in to have an abortion. They very well could have spent weeks and many hours researching it, but for those women that aren't informed, and for them to go in, and as soon as they get into that process, to feel the need to continue, if there are just a few people, few women that given that 24 hours will change their minds, then I think this bill has done a world of good.
Representative Jody Stefanik, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thank you.
Representative Jody Stefanik is a Republican from Baldwin. She serves on the House Health Care Policy Committee that passed the Woman's Right to Know bill last week. When we come back from this break, hour two of Issues Etc., we're going to start out talking about the UFO cult called the Raelians. John Moorhead, Associate Director of the California Office of Watchmen Fellowship, is our guest. And when we come back, and then in the latter part of that hour, our good friend Wesley Smith joins us, just returned from Europe. He's going to tell us about a new report on assisted suicide out of Oregon. He's an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. And in the third hour of the program, the last of this month's series on testing the claims of church growth with Pastor Rod Zwanitzer. Stay with us.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.